Blog Talk Radio.
What is slashing?
Slashing is like death, you know.
Mm-hmm. And there's a penalty for that?
Yeah. And for a trip also, you know,
oh.
Like that. And
mm-hmm.
for hook, like this. Mm-hmm. And for spear, you know, like that.
Mm-hmm.
All bad.
Bad.
You do that, you go to the box, you know, 2 minutes by yourself, and you feel shame, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get free.
Mickey Muhammad.
Hello, Peter. What's happening?
Hey!
Hey!
Who wants to have some fun?
It is Chris Block here, the Third Man In Radio, here on blogtalkradio.com/the Third Man In, here on this Monday night, January the 24th, 2011. It is 8:01 here in Chicago. Alongside, as always, to my right here, it's sound technician himself. It is the Superstar. How are you doing tonight, Superstar?
I am outstanding, and how are you?
A little under the weather, but doing just fine. We got a fantastic show lined up here tonight. We got a lot to talk about, a lot of things Blackhawks related. We got the All-Star game coming up, and I don't know, maybe a couple of people would be interested in that. Not myself, but we might talk about it. But very pleased to welcome back to the show tonight very special guest of ours. I think one of them is his inaugural visit. I'm going to pop him up on the line here in just a second. But the fabulous, the fantastic FifthFeather.com, John and Bob. How you doing tonight, guys?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Good, thanks.
All right. Bob, are you there?
I'm here.
Awesome. All right. We might as well just get right down to it. Well, you know what? First of all, before we do anything Blackhawks related, let's go around the room. Who here thinks Jay Cutler is a pussy?
That's a tough one. Because all indications
is it really a tough
yeah.
one?
Well, from the things I've heard, you know, old Cruz said I saw his knee move sideways, and it was the most disgusting thing I've ever seen. I don't know, but yeah, you'd have to think he's a little bit of a pussy.
Okay, Bob.
I'm going to go with not a pussy. All right, not a pussy.
Yeah, I'm going to say not a pussy. Grade 2 MCL tear. No, not a pussy.
You know what? I get it. I get what, you know, and I think Chicago sports fans are a fascinating case in almost every, line of sport here in Chicago. But I understand the initial suspicion, because this is a sports town, one of the most famous playoff incidents ever. Scottie Pippen didn't want to go in. He went through that. So I understand the initial suspicion. But after watching what Jay Cutler went through at the beginning of the year, where he kept picking himself up off the field and kept continuing to play, I don't know how you could call the guy a pussy. I mean, if he was going to quit on this team, he wouldn't quit in the NFC Championship game. He would have quit at week 6, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so ridiculous that it actually made me slightly depressed today just thinking about it. And it's really just – actually, it's quite disturbing, too, when you think about all these people that were so upset they were burning their jerseys afterwards. And I'm at a loss for words, really, at how people could really think that. If you watch the whole season, the beating, just the physical pounding that the guy took, and then the logic behind it, it's the biggest game. I took a big hit. I'm not playing well. I'm going to just sit this one out.
Right.
It
and
really
people,
makes no sense.
I heard someone, maybe a couple people actually comment that Michael Wilbon within the last 20 hours or so has been on his horse about how the Chicago Bears have had, you know, hundreds of quarterbacks in his lifetime, and none of them have been any good. I think his comment was that Eric Kramer's the best quarterback of his lifetime, who wore a Bears jersey. And it's funny to me, though, that, you know, there have been, yes, maybe hundreds of quarterbacks who have come and gone in the last, you know, what, 40 years or so. And the only constant there really is Chicago and its fans. So maybe the problem isn't, you know, the 15 GMs that have been here or the 20 coaches who have been here. Maybe the Chicago fans are the problem here. That's the only constant.
Yeah,
you brought up a good point with the beating that he's taken all year, and then you've heard so much this week about why is he so grumpy and why is he never smiling? He always seems so angry. Well, you get your ass beat every Sunday. Of course, it's going to piss you off.
I mean, he might be like a punk as a guy, but I don't think he's. I don't think he lacks an enthusiasm for to go out on, you know, on the field in a big game or any game and play for his team. He just, his knee gave out on him. I can, you know, I don't even want to talk about it anymore. Screw this. I'm sure we'll talk about Chicago sports fans again later on in the show. Let's get right into it. Big weekend. I think it's a revealing weekend in some ways. We'll start with the newcomer, the rookie, Bob. This is your first time out. Blackhawks go into Detroit, 4-1. Win against a beat-up Red Wings team, come back to Chicago. It's sort of like the roles are reversed a little bit from the Stanley Cup Finals. Not a lot of depth on the Blackhawks side, but 4-1 loss there. Bob, what did this weekend, if anything, did you learn about the Chicago Blackhawks?
I would say probably nothing. I'd say that this is sort of a status quo kind of weekend. You know, a couple big games, 1-1, which was great. You know, never really quite got into the other, which is, you know, sort of par for the course this season. I think, unfortunately, that's what this year has become, and I don't really see that changing very much, perhaps at least until maybe, the team realizes that, you know, really the playoffs have already started. I think once that really starts to sink in, I think we'll see the group take a step forward. Until that time, I think that, you know, this is just sort of going to be it.
John, the team is in its last eight, 5-2-1. But is it? I mean, I took out of this weekend that the Blackhawks are a team that if they get hot, they could beat anybody at any given time. But the problem I think that they'll run up against a team like Philadelphia is two things. They're just not as deep as Philly scoring-wise and top to bottom, and they're real soft in front of their own goal. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's pretty much spot on. The good thing is if they face Philadelphia, it'll just be in the finals, and then it's just a best of seven, and then anything can happen. And I think the big thing to remember, too, which I'm sure we're going to touch on at some point, is that, you know, this isn't the final roster of, you know, the Hawks team that's going to be, you know, going into the spring, into the playoffs. This is not the team that they're going to be going into with. I think everybody's pretty much, you know, in agreement with that. They're going to make some changes at the back, and they're probably going to, then they have to fill out the bottom of their forward roster. I mean, right now that fourth line is just horrendous. I think, you know, they have, you know, eight moving parts, and nobody really knows which part goes with which. I think after the deadline, I think we're going to have a better idea of what this team is. But for right now, I mean, I think, you know, the good thing is that they're in the West, and I don't think the West is as strong, as top strong as the East. I mean, at the East, you got Philadelphia, you got Pittsburgh, you got Washington. Those are the three teams that are going to be battling out. And I don't think there's anybody in the West that's as good as those three that the Hawks will have to go through. I mean, Vancouver's pretty good, but I mean, the track record there, the Hawks will probably have a bit of an edge, if anything, going into that series. So, I mean, you worry about Vancouver, and, you know, Detroit's always something to worry about, but, you know, I think they're getting a little long in the tooth, and I think the Hawks have, you know, the Hawks are at the point where they don't have to really be that concerned about Detroit. I mean, their main competition, if anything, that somebody that can really hand it to them in a seven-game series is going to come out of the East. But, I mean, and the other side, they can lose to anybody in the West.
You know, an interesting thing occurred this weekend. Obviously, at some point during the game, and I didn't see. Thanks to my adorable little puppy. I got back from Rockford during the day on Saturday, and I was watching the game on the DVR, but I didn't have it recorded. And the dog jumped up on the couch and hit a button and changed the channel, and I missed half the game. But so I don't know exactly when he got hurt, but Jonathan Toews obviously got hurt on Saturday.
It was about 5 minutes left.
Okay. He gets hurt on Saturday. He guts through yesterday. He doesn't practice today, but declares he's going to play tomorrow night. And what is kind of a big game against Minnesota. Minnesota's not all that far behind the Blackhawks. But in the grand scheme of things, I'll throw this out to whoever wants to jump in here. Does it bother you that Jonathan Toews is going to play in what is a relatively meaningless game in the middle of January, even though there are no meaningless games the rest of the season? I do agree with that. But in the grand scheme of things, when he's got a seven-day period, if he chooses to skip the All-Star, if he's really hurt, and if he's sitting out of practice, I would assume that he's hurt. Does it bother anybody that he's just, I'm going to play on Tuesday night, and he's probably going to go to the All-Star game when he could use this time to rest? Does it bother anybody else?
Well, I've already burnt his jersey, so it's I'm out $115 bucks if he comes back. I suppose. If he's hurt, and I think that this is probably consistent with our stance all year, with Kane's injury and Hossa's injuries. I mean, I think when you say it's this time of year, I think that argument cuts both ways. Yes, this time of year, I hope he can get in there, but at the same time, it's this time of year. Do we really have time to be trotting guys out who aren't 100%? And I'd say if he's not 100%, this might be a good time to, to give him a breather.
Superstar, you got any thought on that?
No.
All right, John.
I agree 100%. Do you really want him to go out and depending on the extent of the injury, and make it 10 times worse where he's going to miss an extended period of time, or you say, hey, you know what, we can really use you the rest of the way. Sit down, take the All-Star game off, get a lot of rest. You just had 5 days, and now you get hurt. Yeah, no, I think depending on the extent of the injury, he's got to sit.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the problem is that we don't know what it is. He could have, a grade 2 MCL sprain, or he could just have, a thigh bruise, something along those lines to where, it could be something relatively serious that could become even worse, or it could be something that's not. So we really were at the expense of the Hawks, basically, their decisions. And, that's really all we can go by. If they say that he can play, then they feel that whatever he has can't get any worse, because you don't think that the Hawks would trot him out there if, he's one big hit away from, ending the rest of his season.
Changing a bit for just a second to looking at the Philadelphia Flyers. Obviously, we got a really good look at them in the Stanley Cup Final. The one thing that separated the Blackhawks from the Flyers last year was, without question, the depth on defense. And the over-reliance that they had on Chris Pronger last year, and the fact that as that series wore along, Pronger became less and less of a player as it wore along. Shoes on the other foot right now. The Blackhawks, again, I don't care, we can get into Nick Leddy later, but I don't care what you think of Nick Leddy and how much better you think he is than Nick Boynton, anybody that's listening, not necessarily who's on the line. But Nick Leddy played under 10 minutes yesterday. I mean, he barely played. I mean, he's not playing any more than, 9:23 against the Philadelphia Flyers. He's not playing any more than Boynton or Cullimore was. So, you have this situation where there's this over-reliance on Duncan Keith, Brent Seabrook, and the Campbell-Jalmerson pairing. Are the Flyers with O'Donnell and Mazzaros, are they, regular season aside, are they poised to take the East in your opinion?
Well, I would say they probably – it's either going to – I think, between them or Pittsburgh, and if Crosby's head is still foggy come playoffs, then I think absolutely Philadelphia is going to be the team to beat. That the bottom of their defense – and, it'll be funny is if they win the Cup next year and then, say, Bobrovsky hits his bonus and Van Riemsdyk hits his, well, then they're going to have the same cap purge that the Hawks had this previous summer. And then I think you might see – all these a bunch of people will start writing, well, is this really good for the NHL for teams to win the cup? And then completely disassemble their team afterwards if the Flyers end up winning the Cup, which is, you know, a pretty good possibility now. But, yeah, I would say it's Philadelphia or Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and, you know, I think Philadelphia is quite like the Blackhawks last year and quite like the Red Wings the couple years prior to that, in that there's no wasted energy on that roster. I mean, you know, from the top line to the fourth line up front, you know, those guys are doing sort of, you know, what prototypically those guys should be doing. And that third pairing, I mean, that's quite a pairing. You know, I think that at least Mazaros isn't, you know, a third pairing defenseman on most NHL teams. But, you know, he sort of fits the role. You know, he fits that sort of big-bodied kind of, you know, guy who, you know, can kill penalties and has sort of a big shot and does sorts of those things. And I guess goaltending is their big question mark, but, you know, I've said it too much to say that that's a problem going into springtime, because it never really seems to be with many teams. So they're going to be really, really tough to beat. They're good.
John, is there anybody else, whether it be in the East or the West, that has stood out to you at this point of the season that looks like, you know, a formidable Cup contender, at least at this point?
Well, I think Washington, the interesting thing about them, and, you know, you got to see it on 24/7 a little bit, and then, you know, the Winter Classic was kind of garbage because of the ice. You know, they were basically playing on slush. But if Washington can learn to play with a lead and to play smart with a lead and to, you know, maybe slow up teams through the neutral zone and not let them get a full, you know, rush of steam going through the other way, you know, I think Washington can be a team that you can't just say, well, you know, they collapsed in the playoffs the last couple of years, and they're going to do the same thing again this time. You know, there might be something there with the Caps. I think a lot of people might be quick to kind of just toss them aside and say that, you know, they're not legit. But, you know, I mean, that top six, you're not going to find a better top six in the NHL right now than those guys. You'll be hard pressed. I think that's probably the one team that can kind of jump out, and people will say, well, why did we forget about them? But, you know, they never really went away to begin with.
Yeah, you know, I think for me personally, I, you know, not that I'm, you know, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago when we talked about the mid-season analysis and our mid-season awards. The one team that really, I can't figure it out, but the New York Rangers. Is there a guy in the league, aside from maybe Barry Trotz, that's done a better coaching job to this point this year than John Tortorella in New York? You know, he's got one of the best goaltenders in the league, obviously, but, you know, he's dealt with a lot of injuries there in New York, an inconsistent Gabrick. You know, he's got Brian Boyle and Nisimov that are leading the way a lot of nights. He's got nothing from Chris Drury. And, you know, his defense is sort of weird, too. But to me, if Crosby is healthy, I really like that defense there in Pittsburgh, and I still think that they're grittier and they can win games and they can win a series. If the season ended today, that would be your first round matchup, Pittsburgh and Washington, which would be great for television. I like Boston. I still like Boston, but you know, the one team that no one really talks about, and it's still surprising that they're at where they're at, 30-15-5 right now, is the Tampa Bay Lightning. Now, I wanted to talk about this because it's in the news. Evgeny Nabokov. Now, why is it that the Tampa Bay Lightning, I mean, I know that they traded for Dwayne Rolison, but what has Dan Ellis proven this year other than the fact that they needed to trade for another goaltender? Mike Smith is, you know, he's going to be in the AHL. If, you know, he'll be put on waivers as soon as he's healthy. Why doesn't Tampa Bay take a shot at Evgeny Nabokov, considering what the price was? Anybody
I think with Nabokov, I think now I'm not really 100% sure how the waiver wire process works. Now, did the Islanders get first dibs on it and they just claimed him and then they got him, or did it roll all the way through each team and then everybody got a chance to grab him and it was actually just the Islanders that were the only team that grabbed him? Do you know that?
Well, no. See, here's the thing. Like, you know, since Nabokov was playing for another pro team, he got released from Russia. He comes over. He signed.
Right.
what has to happen, and this is what happened in the case of, you know, even with Ryan Johnson. It happened with Ryan Johnson. It happened with Garnet Exelby. These players, they agree to contracts with the team, but since it's past a certain date of the season, they have to be offered up to the rest of the league. And then once, you know, they go through waivers, 25 teams could put in a claim, but it's the team with the worst record at that date who would get them. You know, but my point was more of, you know, there's a lot of people complaining right now that, oh, Nabokov doesn't want to go to the Islanders. Well, why would you want to go to the Islanders? He made a deal with the Red Wings. He was up on the market. Everybody had a shot at him. You know, the Red Wings are the one that made the deal. If the Islanders wanted him, they could make the deal. You know, I mean, does that bother you? First of all, let's start there. First of all, does it bother you that, you know, Evgeny Nabokov signs with the Red Wings, but he's got to be offered up to the rest of the league, and some other team can just pluck him away? Does it bother you at this stage of the season, given that he was a free agent, you know, available to anybody that could have signed him to a deal?
What bothers me is that these players negotiate with the teams and they sign the contract with the teams that they want to play with, and then they get offered up to the rest of the league. I think that's where the kind of like the disconnect is at, is where these guys are, you know, the agents are making deals with the GMs of specific teams, and then all of a sudden, then they get offered up to the rest of the league, and then they say, oh, you know what, well, you actually got to go here. You can't go there where you wanted to go play.
Well, I think otherwise, you know, you might have a process that's a month long. I mean, it sounds like maybe, you know, you think that that they should go through some sort of a waiver process first, and then if they were claimed, then they'd have to work something out. And either way, I think you sort of get to the same spot that Nabokov's in now, where, you know, either he's going to report or he's not, and at the end of the day, you know, he's going to play for who he wants to, or he's just not going to show up anywhere. And, you know, I think especially with Snow's history and sort of dealing with goaltenders like they're commodities, I don't know that I'd want to go there either. I mean, that's not even counting the fact that they really, really blow and nobody wants to be there to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I get why the Islanders, for the integrity of the NHL, the Islanders had to put a claim in them. So, you know, and they were, you know, we could see this coming from a mile away. But, you know, my thing is, it's more to, you know, you're right, Bob, in the case that if you were to reverse the situation, it would prolong it. But the reason why the waiver process is there is sort of the competitive balance. But I think the NHL and the PA need to get together in the next CBA and decide, well, the competitive balance thing is supposed to be taken care of by the salary cap. So it's like you have the salary cap there so that a team can't load up on players. And can't, you know, Evgeny Nabokov's not on the market there. And, you know, let's say the Red Wings only have $1 million to give him, you know, prorated. But these other teams want, you know, can offer him more. But, you know, if without a salary cap, the Red Wings say, you know, we'll just give you $5 million. And the smaller market teams are shut out of that process. Well, the salary cap is there to open things up to these other teams. The New York Islanders could have come in and said, hey, instead of you getting – and what is the number? $570,000 for the rest of the year. We'll give you $1.2 million for the rest of the year. You know, I mean, I think the NHL's got to decide. It's either one or the other. So we don't have this situation where players are, like you said, they make this deal with a team. That's where they want to go. They were a free agent. Anybody could have come in and negotiated with them. They decide where they want to go, and then they're taken away from that. To me, I can't blame the player for deciding, hey, I don't want to go there because that's not where I've made my deal.
Sure. But, you know, in the Bakos case, though, you know, he had his chance months ago to sign wherever he wanted to. And, you know, now we're so far along in the process, he's already walked away from one contract halfway across the world. You know, to me, to play in the league that I watch every night, you know, if you want back in, you know, maybe you have to do it through Long Island. I mean, I don't, you know, to me, I can see where there's, you know, where there are issues with, you know, with the teams and the larger or broader competitive balance and all that. But in terms of Nabokov, I mean, I don't care. You know, I think he needs to pay his due. He needs to, if he wants back in the league, the way is through one of the worst teams in it. And that's the end of story as far as I'm concerned.
Couldn't agree
yeah,
more.
I think I,
Yeah, I think Nabokov's an interesting case, and I think he's sort of a lightning rod because he did bolt for the KHL. He comes back, and now it's like, you know, he's trying to pick his spots, and I think it's struck a chord with a lot of people, to whereas, you know, a situation with, like, Kyle Wellwood. Kyle Wellwood was going into, you know, he would have gone to St. Louis with a chance to play some top 6 minutes, to where he's in San Jose now playing on their fourth line. You know, that's a situation where it's not working out well for the player. You know, he's not on a playoff team now, to where, you know, I mean, I guess neither one would a playoff team right now, but you know what I'm saying? I mean, it was a better situation for him. He got prevented from being there. You know, Marek Svatos, you know, who knows? I mean, who cares about, but yeah, I think that it's an interesting case that, you know, these players that they, you know, again, they're free agents. Anybody could swoop in and take them. And then it's like the Islanders, you know, it's like they let somebody else do all their dirty work. You know, it's like the NHL team with the least amount of cap money makes their deal with Nabokov, and then the Islanders come in and poach that contract because, you know, in order for them to get that player, they would have to pay so much more. I think that's a glitch in the system.
It's the old version of cock blocking.
Well, the Nabokov deal, that's just a 1 year deal, right? Was there maybe an option or something for another? No, I don't think you can even do options in the NHL.
Well,
it was just a 1 year deal, wasn't it?
Yeah, but the interesting thing about it is I heard it. It was said today that the Islanders can petition the league that if he doesn't report, that the deal just overlaps and goes into next year. So, you know, if he just decides not to report, the league or the Islanders can suspend him, and then the contract begins next year. You know, I don't know why they would want to put themselves through that. Why not just trade him or, you know, whatever. But, you know, that's something that's being talked about right now. I think right now where it stands is they're going to wait this thing out, hope that Nabokov just says, fine, I'll go, I'll play for a few weeks, and then, you know, maybe we'll see what we can work out. But
right. Well, I mean, and, you know, I certainly don't think that that they're looking to, you know, ride him through the end of the season. I mean, obviously he's going somewhere. He's going to go to a competitor. You know, I don't know that that he should be too worried about it. I mean, whether it's Detroit or, you know, some other team that's either in the playoffs or, you know, on the cusp of it, I think he'll be fine, and I think he should just go.
Moving back to the Blackhawks, let's talk about making the Blackhawks better. You know, obviously I think that we all know, we talked about a little bit before, where the Blackhawks are weak. The third pairing on defense and a little bit of grit up front. Let's start with you, John. First of all, I mean, are there targets that you can see out there that are tangible assets the Blackhawks can acquire, whether it be now or maybe waiting out a team's playoff hopes for a few weeks? You know, talk about that.
Well, the one guy that comes to mind, who I know you've kind of been beating the drum for a little while now, is Steve Monador. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, Buffalo, as far as I know, they're nowhere close. I mean, they're kind of teetering on the edge of competing for that playoff spot and not, and I think they're kind of leaning towards not. So, you know, Monador's a guy that seems kind of interesting. You know, and then you can pick up a third or fourth line guy from pretty much, you know, any team who's selling at the deadline. And those guys aren't too hard to find. You know, the thing where the Hawks are in trouble now is with their 50-man roster being fully loaded. You know, you got all 50 spots taken up, and somebody like Ben Eager, who could have, or Jamie Leggenbruner, who could have been easily had for, you know, one of their plethora of draft picks, you know, you couldn't get those guys because your 50-man roster was full, and you can't, you know, you just can't cut a guy right in the middle of the season. I'm pretty sure that's not how it works in the NHL. So, you know, they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, to where they have to decide, you know, you can't trade a player for, you know, somebody like Ben Eager when he can be had for a fifth-round pick, or you can't trade somebody like Dave Bolin for Jamie Langenbrunner because you're just selling so far low, it's ridiculous. So, you know, as far as specific guys, nobody really jumps out. Like, there's not this, like, big old name out there that, yes, that's the guy that they need to get, and that's who's the missing link. I mean, you know, Florida's a team that's got about three or four different guys who would probably look pretty nice in a Blackhawk uniform. But, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's hard to explain. It's hard to figure out a specific guy that they would need, because they have so – I think they have so many needs to where it's just hard where there's not that one guy.
Bob?
Now that we have this competitive balance, of course, at this point, at least, so few teams are out of it. So there are so few names floating around out there. I guess Atlanta's sort of one of those teams that pops into mind that, might be selling. I think, you know, there are a couple familiar faces over there. It is, I guess, funny that in such a short period of time, the defensive depth has fallen so far to the point where they absolutely have to get a bona fide defenseman in here, because unfortunately it doesn't really appear as though they have one on the third pairing at all. Where we were last year at the beginning of the year, that nobody was happy with Hopel as a sixth defenseman, and I think people would do quite a bit to get someone like him, or even to get him, back at some point.
How do you feel? I'll start personally. I was one of Brent Sobel's biggest defenders until people finally came around on him a little bit. I think it wasn't until the playoffs last year. But I think that's a backwards move. I love Brent Sobel as a player, and I've heard people, even Forklift over at Hockey Night, say that he believes that that's a guy that's going to be brought in next year. I'm against that. I think it's a backward move. I don't care what the price is. That's why I bring up guys like Monitor. You want guys. One of the reasons why Letty was brought up out of essentially necessity is because he can move the puck a little bit, and he's mobile, to where his Boynton wasn't. And Cullimore was fine. I mean, Cullimore gets a bad rap for his play. He was fine all year long. But he was the one guy that could go down, and I guess that they felt that they could risk losing. What do you guys think? Let's start with Sobel. Would you mind Sobel coming back, or do you think that doesn't help at all?
I, to be honest, I don't think it's, you said a backwards move. I don't think it's that. I think the problem really is that, the Hawks have, of course, a bunch of sixth or seventh defensemen. And, that might be what Sobel is. But, I think they need like a five. They need somebody who can sort of carry the pairing. And, Sopel's, of course, not going to do that. Letty and Hendry, they're sort of the type that can do that. But as much as I really, really liked Hendry a few years ago, thought that he really, really showed some promise when he first came up. I think actually because Brent Sobel broke something way back when. I just don't see either one of those two doing it. And I think it could be a lot worse than Brent Sobel. That's for sure.
John?
Yeah, probably around the same lines. I would like to see somebody new. I'm kind of on board with you, Chris, that it might be kind of a backwards move. I'd like to see somebody a little younger, somebody maybe with a little bit of a higher ceiling than a Brent Sobel, just to see, we know what Sobel can do. If there's somebody out there available that you can get for around the same price, you might as well do it.
Yeah, one of my concerns with Sobel is we know the kind of, we have firsthand knowledge of the hard miles that he has on him. And it's like I just sense that, you bring him in and you just never know how long he's going to last. He went through, that long playoff run last year, and he's been healthy all year this year, and that surprised me to this point. So I think, bringing him back into this situation, I think that's a little risky, given the fact that he's had his health for so long. I think at some point that's going to go the other way. I think to back to your point, John, about the 50-man roster, I think one of the things that you're going to look at that's going to happen here fairly soon is a move to create that roster spot. Because if you look at what the Blackhawks have, probably their most desirable asset they'd be willing to trade, and I don't think it's player. They have three second-round picks in this upcoming draft. I think that when you're talking about a deadline move for a guy who's not a first-line player, whether it be that fifth or sixth defenseman that's a third or a fourth on another team, which is what they should be shooting for, or you know a guy to play, you know, a grinder that can score some to play. It's one of those second-round picks or possibly the extra third that they got from Toronto, which will be a high pick as well. But you're talking about Atlanta's pick in the Andrew Ladd trade. Calgary's going to be a high pick. Those are probably their most desirable assets. So what do you got to do? You got to create a roster spot so you can make that deal. I don't think that you want to risk waiting till the trade deadline and trying to throw somebody like an Ivan Vishnevsky or Boynton or Ryan Johnson into a deal that maybe doesn't get made on that deadline because someone says, well, I don't want that guy or I don't have room for that guy because I have another deal in the works. So I think what you're going to see here in the next few weeks is the Blackhawks make that courtesy deal, so to speak, of moving a guy, whether it's in Rockford or probably a guy that's in Rockford. Rockford, because of Dylan Olsen, having to leave school, they've got a log jam on defense down there too. Ivan Vishnevsky has been a healthy scratch the last two games. They sent Simone Denny Pepin down. So you could see a move where one of those guys gets moved for either a low-round draft pick or the quote-unquote future considerations just to create that sort of flexibility when Stan Bowman's talking to other general managers and what he can do. To that, further that point, is there a guy on the roster, on the NHL roster, that either any of you three think, we'll start with you, John, is there a guy on the NHL roster you think the Blackhawks can most do away with that won't hurt them, but still it has to be a guy that another team would want? We're not talking about John Scott,
right,
or Nick Boynton. It's got to be someone that someone else desires, and you say, well, yeah, that kind of hurts, but with what we're getting back in return, it's still a positive.
Well, I think it would be Hjalmarsson, I think, is the guy that you got to look at right now as your most tradable asset with getting something in return. I mean, he has been, as far as a guy who's taken a step back, I think he's taken the biggest step back this year as far as the way he plays and everything else. I mean, his decision-making, when even going back 2 years ago, I remember in the playoffs against Detroit and Doc Emrick just marveling over, he would make the smart, subtle play. He would always wait that extra split second and make the right pass to his partner or chip it around the boards to his partner, waiting that extra second. And now it just seems like he gets that puck and he just buries his head and he just fires it around the boards as hard as he can. It seems like those are the mistakes that he should have been making his first year, and he should have been playing the way he played his rookie year now. So I think I don't know if you're going to be able to get, a quote-unquote legitimate, really good player from him, but you'll be able to get something. I don't know if you can still get a first and a third-round pick or whatever San Jose would have given up for compensation for signing him. But, yeah, I think Hjalmarsson is the guy right now who is the most tradable asset on the Hawks.
I think the problem with that, though, is that because of the offer sheet, he can't be traded until the offseason.
Is that a fact?
I could pull up the PDF right now, but no, I'm pretty sure of that.
Okay. Well, then if he can't get traded, then I don't really know where else you could look on that roster as far as, getting something for value in return. I mean, obviously, Jack Skilly and Victor Stahlberg, those guys are all available, but I don't know if you could really get anything back from them. Maybe you could look at Troy Brouwer, but then all of a sudden, then you got a pretty large gaping hole on your first line.
Yeah, the problem with Troy Brouwer, and that's an interesting name that I've thought a lot about too. I think you look at the intangibles in Troy Brouwer, though. You know, he leads your team in hits. An interesting stat. When you look at who's drawing penalties, who's creating power play opportunities for the Blackhawks. I don't think it'd be a surprise to anybody that the guy who leads the Blackhawks in that category with 16 penalties drawn is Jonathan Toews. The second guy who was actually tied with Toews is Victor Stahlberg. You know, but the problem with Victor Stahlberg, and that I don't have immediately in front of me, but I think the last time Victor Stahlberg, I think there's been two penalties that he's drawn since the beginning of December. So he's trending backwards. Brouwer would be the third guy with 15. And then you're looking at Bickle, Kopechki. And then way down that list is Marian Hossa with a big whopping 4, including one the other night against Nashville. You know, Brouwer is a guy that, you know, I just wonder if you lose him. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a little bit of that scoring touch. It's that compete level. It's a guy that's willing to go to the net. I don't know if that's too much to give up, because Brian Bickle, and I think that everybody's seen this, if you really think about it and go back, where does Brian Bickle score his goals? And I can tell you where he scores his goals. He scores them 30 feet from the net on that play where he drifts into the slot, he gets the pass, and he goes high glove every time. For something that I'm working on, I went back and looked at every Brian Bickle goal that he scored in the National Hockey League, 14 of them, I believe, off the top of my head. All but two of them, he's aimed high glove. And we're talking about, I mean, these aren't, you know, he's not going, for whatever reason, when he does go to the net, he doesn't have touch around the net. So Brouwer has that. So if I was to pick one or the other, I would pick Bickle. But let's go throw it over to you, Bob. I mean, those guys, anybody, you know, Skilly, Brouwer, Stahlberg, Bickle, who stands out to you as a guy that the Blackhawks would be willing to give away that somebody else would want?
To be honest, in terms of wingers, excluding maybe Sharp, if we in fact consider him a winger at this point, and of course Kane, I don't know if there's anybody that, you know, that they couldn't necessarily afford to move it if they got something nice back. Now, of course, you know, Hossa, he can't go anywhere. He's not going anywhere. But, you know, I think that there are 6 or 8 different directions they can go. The problem is, though, I think that, you know, if you turn to, a Brouwer or Kopechki, two guys who I think, you know, have some decent value, you know, while we've taken a lot of time to discuss, you know, the third pairing, I mean, I think they need something sort of all over, you know, I mean, they need more than one guy. And, you know, if you take Kopechki and Brouwer off, I think, you know, you take some of that grit, especially some of it on the top couple lines, and then, you know, you really start running into problems. So, you know, I think that's going to be a problem. I think finding people on the NHL roster who the Blackhawks are willing to deal in, who somebody might have some interest in. And I don't know that I necessarily see it. I mean, I think Skilly and Stahlberg are exciting, and, you know, their projects certainly, you know, I don't see them really netting anyone who's going to help. And, you know, that's the problem.
I think the thing that makes them desirable, though, and maybe a little bit more attractive in a deal is that there is, I think people would look at them and think that maybe there is some upside there, plus they're going to be restricted free agents. I mean, I think that's what makes them a possibility in a trade when you look at, you know, Calgary, like a Curtis Glencross, who would come in he would kind of fill what Andrew Ladd did last year. Now, not what Andrew Ladd's doing this year in Atlanta, because that's a different guy, but what Andrew Ladd was doing last year. I think that's a smaller move that the Blackhawks could make, and maybe, you know, a cheap guy that's still going to be an RFA that has some upside, maybe that would be desirable to a team that is probably going to lose Curtis Glencross anyway. So, you know, that's a possibility. But, yeah, I really, even if the Blackhawks are going to have to trade Troy Brouwer in the offseason, I hesitate to move him at this point just because I think that he's too valuable to what, you know, what they need right now.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know. I think I've seen a little too much of Skilly and Stahlberg to think that anybody would sort of bite on that. You know, I think each is, you know, probably a bottom six type. you know, with a lot of speed and, you know, with, you know, you said some upside. You know, the problem is that, you know, neither one can really do anything that the bottom six players typically do. And, you know, I don't really see anybody sort of missing that, you know, if they take a close look.
Well, I think, you know, when you talk about Stallberg or Skilly, I think you could also sweeten the pot with one of those third, you know, second-round draft picks that you have as well.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a larger deal, you know, but that's why I think that something has to happen first. You know, there's going to be some sort of a sacrifice made, and I don't know who that would be. I don't know, you know, Ryan Johnson was up, you know, for the whole league to take a look at. Nobody wanted him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you go back, and I know a lot of people are puzzled. I think, John, you wrote, maybe you were the other day, you wrote about it. You know, it's like, well, why is the guy here? And you think you go back and really look at it, the timeline of it, Dave Bowen had that, you know, he missed that practice before that game in San Jose. And that was when they brought Ryan Johnson to Rockford. He played the one game in Rockford. Bowen missed the game in Colorado, I believe, again, all off the top of my head. But, and then they signed him immediately. So I think that Johnson was brought in for Dave Bowen back concerns. So we can presume it's his back. I think we should always presume it's his back. But, you know, now that Dave Bowen's healthy and playing the best that he's played all year, Ryan Johnson doesn't have a place. And, you know, the other thing to think about and to consider, and I would be one, it's like, okay, you're going to send Nick Leddy down. Why not send, you know, who cares? Risk sending Ryan Johnson through waivers. He already passed once. He'll probably pass again. Send him down. I mean, he's wasting cap space on the roster. But the problem with that is that Rockford's already at their limit for veterans that they can put in the lineup. So you can send Ryan Johnson down there, but he's not going to play. You know, maybe that doesn't matter to anybody, but that is something to consider. Because Rockford has, with Cullimore being down there, Garnet X will be Cullimore, Tafe, Brookbank, Jessamine, and Petunia all count as veterans. And Petunia and Jessamine have a veteran exemption, but that's it. They can only have six in the lineup, and they were all in the lineup the other night, so they can't have any more. So,
and I think that kind of speaks to a larger degree. I mean, I don't follow many other teams' farm systems and everything else, so I don't know if a lot of teams, you know, like Detroit or Boston or teams like that, if they're really, you know, if they're so clustered that they can't drop a guy, you know, a veteran that they signed to their farm team because they're already at the veteran limit, and then they can't make a trade because they're at the main, the 50-man roster limit. To me, it speaks to, I'm just getting the sneaking suspicion that Stan Bowman is in over his head when you start to add all these things up. I mean, I'll have to look around the rest of the league and see what everybody else has got on their farm team and who's at the veteran limit and everything else. But to me, it's starting to become pretty evident that he's in over his head on something like this, because it just doesn't seem like that this is normal, that this is how normal NHL teams operate, that they can't, you know, they sign a guy and then they can't drop him down to the farm team because there's no room for him here because they're already at their veteran limit in Rockford or in their AHL team. And I think that's kind of the bigger issue that we're starting to scratch the surface on.
Well, yeah, I think that sort of cuts the other way too, because I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, when the salary cap purge came up, that, you know, that the idea was, you know, with the roster's last few players to try to catch lightning in a bottle somewhere. And, you know, I think that, you know, looking back on it, it's obvious that hasn't really happened. It's almost funny how, you know, they really haven't had anyone new really step up. And, you know, what were the odds on that months ago? You know, we all talked in the summer, you know, who's going to be that guy? Who's going to be the guy, you know, who's our Andrew Ladd or, you know, who's Ben Eager? And the answer sort of nobody. But, you know, there were a couple different ways they could have gone. I think, you know, they tried the lightning in a bottle thing, and that's sort of an all-in proposition, because as soon as you do that, there are all sorts of ramifications that follow. When you sign six guys, it's more difficult on the salary cap than if you sign two, no matter how much you're paying any of the guys. And, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they're dealing with some of those issues, but, you know, I don't know that there was that much of a choice at the time.
You know, I'll give Stan Bowman a little bit of leeway on the Dylan Olsen thing. That one, I don't see where he had any other choice. Dylan Olsen didn't give him a choice. You know, I mean, you can't have the kid just sitting out there doing nothing at this critical point of development. You know, so I'll give him the benefit of the doubt there. I'm still against it with Nick Leddy and bringing him out of college and not sending him to junior hockey and forcing him into the lineup this early, because I don't think it's doing him any good. But he's proven that he can handle himself at the AHL and the NHL level. I'm going to tell you something right now about Brandon Peary. Brandon Peary should not be in professional hockey. He's undersized. He doesn't compete like a professional. I've never seen a guy. Brandon Peary plays on the half wall on the power play. I've never seen a guy get the puck taken away from him more on the power play than Brandon Peary. And it's not just like he gets poke check and the puck gets taken away. He will hold the puck on the half wall, and you know, a forward will come to him, step up on him. Brandon Peary will turn his back, and then the defenseman will step up. They will, you know, one will take the puck, and then the other one. You know, it's amazing to me. Brandon Peary's offsides constantly. About the only thing that Brandon Peary aggressively does every single game is complain to the referees. He should not be a pro, and we talked about it before the season started. When John, when you were on the show, you know, his junior rights were held by Saginaw. You know who's first place in their division right now in the OHL and the best team in their conference? Saginaw. That's where Brandon Peary should be playing hockey. You know, I mean, I'm not an OHL expert. I didn't know that Saginaw was going to be that good, but somebody in the Blackhawks organization should have known that. You know, Saginaw is going to be competing for Memorial Cup, at least an OHL championship. That's where he should be right now. He's not a professional hockey player. He's got 19 games without a goal. He's got 5 points in that span. He doesn't compete hard every night, and he's a waste of space in the power play. He shouldn't be there, and that speaks to bad general management.
Yeah, and I think that kind of the unfortunate thing about that is everybody could have kind of seen that coming. Anybody who saw Brandon Peary play last year at RPI kind of knew that he was not a professional player. I mean, I saw him play a handful of games, and Jerry DiMigo was the best player on that team by a country mile. I mean, Jerry DiMigo made that team go. He played on the same line as Brandon Peary. Brandon Peary led the nation in assists, and I would venture to say that half of those came off of Jerry DiMigo's goals. Or Chase Polacek, who was the Hobie Baker finalist on RPI. It was those three on a line. And I believe they were also the top power play unit. But that, I mean, Brandon Peary was the worst out of those three players. And, you know, he kind of picked up a lot of garbage points because of who he was playing with. And, you know, he just kind of touched the puck and they take it and they score. And, you know, it's kind of unfortunate because I think he's going to become a cautionary tale at this point from, you know, I haven't seen him play in Rockford as much as you have, but I did see him play quite a bit at RPI. So, you know, what you're saying is not far from what I remember him like. And, you know, it's just really unfortunate that it could, you know, that a high second-round pick like that, somebody who had, a decent amount of value, is, you know, just wasting away in Rockford.
Yeah, you know, when I talk about, you know, his dry spell here, I mean, it's not like he's not getting first-line minutes, or he's not, you know, he's on the second line mostly. But it's not like he's not getting a lot of minutes. He's constantly been on the power play. He's never been taken off the power play, no matter how bad the power play gets. And Rockford's power play is bad. I mean, it's running in the last about 20 games or so. It's running at about a 5 or a 6% clip. It's awful, okay? And he's constantly on that power play because they have little in the other way of options, because Morin was up with the USA and now he's hurt. Ben Smith has a concussion. He's out. So, you know, they have little other options. Evan Brophy's not a power play guy, you know, but still, he should be developing where he can play his best hockey and grow and mature into a better player and then get here. And it's the same argument that I have with Leddy. I don't care how smooth, you know, much, you know, more pleasing to the eyes that he is to fans than Nick Boynton is. The player that you want Nick Leddy to be, he isn't right now, and he's not going to turn into that player playing 9 minutes and 23 seconds a night. It's not going to happen. You know, the Detroit Red Wings, the model, the thing that the Blackhawks want to be, they have one of the best defense, probably the best defensive prospect in at least the States right now, in Brendan Smith. Brendan Smith, Kenny Holland has acknowledged that Brendan Smith is good enough right now to play on the Detroit Red Wings. But he said, you know what, it doesn't hurt him at all to play a full year, his first year out of Wisconsin, and he played 3 years at Wisconsin. It doesn't hurt him at all to stay in Grand Rapids. He's one of the, as a rookie, he's one of the leaders in points as a defenseman. He's a fabulous player to watch, and he's going to stay down there all year and learn the pro game and learn the rigors of the schedule and all that, and then when it's ready, they'll bring him up. And with Stan Bowman, you know, you could talk about necessity. It was not a necessity. There were other options, and now partly because Joe Quenneville ran Nick Boynton dry, you know, I think there's some culpability that Quenneville has to share in this. But now he has to have Letty up, and he's burnt a year on his entry level. And, you know, and now with Olsen being up, now 3 years from now, Olsen and Letty, two of the future of your defense, are coming up at the same time. And it doesn't make sense to me. Talking about contract extensions, I want to talk about this. And we're going to get to Chicago. This is where Chicago Blackhawks fans come into play. Brent Seabrook's contract extension and his negotiations, and I think that there's a really good reason why this thing is going to take a while. And Stan Bowman's been real mum on it, and it's going to be very difficult. You know, it's a complicated thing with Brent Seabrook, and I think you got to go back to the Duncan Keith contract. And when we looked at that contract, forget about length. I mean, that, you know, everybody wants the point, I think. The problem is with the salary cap number being the average over term. Everybody points to that number and wants to compare Brent Seabrook to that number. Why don't we start with this? Bob, I'll start with you. What's the maximum length that you would, as good of a player as Seabrook is, what's the maximum length you'd go with Seabrook?
Well, you know, I'm not a big fan of the long deals. I think that very few of us will be in a few more years. I think something like, you know, a 6-year deal is as long as I would go. And, of course, I'd prefer to be shorter than that.
John?
Yeah, I don't like the long-term deals either. I would say between, you know, 6 or 7 years is probably as far as I would go, especially when you're talking about somebody like a defenseman where they're, you know, sometimes their skills can deteriorate pretty rapidly.
Okay. So, you know, I think that, you know, if I'm, and I look at this, I'll be the first one to say I'm a player's guy. Okay. And I'll look at this from Brent Seabrook's situation. I'm going in and I'm representing Brent Seabrook. And I would think that too, you know, because whether it's a fan, as a player, as an organization, a lot can change in 3 years. Forget about 5 or 6. I mean, the Blackhawks, this thing could go south in a hurry if Marian Hossa never gets healthy 100% and could play anywhere near the level he did, you know, when he started the season at. If Taves becomes injury prone over the life of his contract, I mean, this thing could go south in a hurry. You know, if Duncan Keith is a minus player throughout the life of his contract, I mean, you have problems. So I think as a player, if I was Brent Seabrook, and I'm sure he loves Chicago, but I would be cautious about wrapping myself up in a deal here too. I would want to get as much money as I can right now and then leave myself open to where, you know, in 4, 5, 6 years, you know, he's a BC boy. I don't care what the rivalry is or what he thinks about Chicago. There's a possibility that he may want to finish his career in Vancouver. So if I was him, I'd want to leave myself that option. Now, you know, what's the standard then? I mean, what do you guys think as far as, all right, let's say 5 or 6 years, what is Brent Seabrook worth?
Well, you know, I think before we touch on numbers, I think there's also something at play here, and that's that, you know, as successful as the Hawks have been the last couple of years, players who have earned money have either gotten the money or they've left. And, you know, there's no one here who's here on any sort of a discount. You know, so in terms of what that standard is, I think that's where you start. You know, I don't see any hometown discounts anywhere. And, you know, perhaps some might think that, you know, maybe a couple of the personalities are personalities that, you know, might take those sorts of things. Now, I think it's silly to think that from either side, but, you know, I'm sure people think that. I think that, you know, Seabrook's going to get his money, and they need to decide whether they're going to give it to him or not. You know, I meant actually to look before we started, but, you know, I thought sort of you know, sort of a humorous place to start would be looking at the salaries of the 17 Canada defensemen from last year, excluding Doughty, of course, because of his age. But, you know, I don't think there are too many nice numbers there from our perspective.
Yeah, and Shea Weber's coming. His deal is coming up, so that's a negotiation that Brent Seabrook's agent may want to look at as well.
I think you're not looking at anything less than five, as far as now. If you're going to get into money, as far as cap hits and stuff like that, you're not looking at anything less than $5 million a year. You'd be foolish to think that he would, and he'd be foolish to take anything less than $5 million a year. I just don't, you know, as Bob said, there's only seven spots on Team Canada's roster, and he was one of those seven. So he's going to be making, you know, he's not going to be making Nicholas Hjalmarsson money anymore. He's stepping it up into another class.
Yeah, you know, and I saw a lot of people, and I want to start this because this infuriated me. I was hot about this for a week. After Jack Johnson signed his deal, and Blackhawks fans all over the place, whether they write about the team or whether they talk about the team, whatever they do, they all said, well, that set the number. That set the bar. Jack Johnson and Brent Seabrook, how do they relate whatsoever other than they both played in the Olympics? You know, Jack Johnson's 2 years away, or Brent Seabrook's 1 year away from his UFA year. Okay? Jack Johnson's 24. Okay? Brent Seabrook played on Canada, the gold medal team, and he's won a Stanley Cup. Jack Johnson's played on a team that's never done a damn thing. Okay? Jack Johnson, an offensive guy, towards Brent Seabrook's an all-around guy. Okay? I'll say this. Brent Seabrook's the best passer the Blackhawks have on defense. Okay? So you can start there. I think he's a better passer than Duncan Keith. I think he makes, Brian Campbell's pretty smooth, but Brent Seabrook makes some passes that Brian Campbell just doesn't make. Some of those long bombs, but there's some crisp passes that Brent Seabrook makes. But regardless of that, that Duncan Keith contract, okay, we're all in agreement that 5-6 years is pretty much the max. Okay, if you're Brent Seabrook's agent and you walk into Stan Bowman's office and say, you know what, yeah, if we're going to listen to Blackhawks fans, because Blackhawks fans love the players until it comes time to pay them, and then they treat the players like assholes. So you're going to go into Stan Bowman's office and say, you know what? Yeah, half of what Duncan Keith is making sounds about fair. No, Duncan Keith's making $8 million a year. He averages, over the first 6 years of his contract, he averages 7.9. Okay, you're not getting Brent Seabrook. I mean, whatever you're getting Seabrook at, because of the salary cap situation, it basically comes down to how swell of a guy Brent Seabrook is. Because if he wanted to stand out and say, I want 6.5, 7, he could make that argument because of what they paid Duncan Keith. It's not because of you're going with a shorter term, most likely with Seabrook, it's not that you throw Duncan Keith's cap number out the window. It's irrelevant. It's what he's making in that window. And that's where you start. I've always maintained that 5.5 is where I would start with Seabrook. I would love to have him at that number, but if I'm his agent, I want more than that just based on what Brent Seabrook's partners make.
Just to touch up on your Jack Johnson comparison too, Jack Johnson has been a minus player his entire career. He's never finished with a positive plus minus.
Yeah. I couldn't believe
just
it. You know, and some people, you know, I mean, even Forklift did it. And I love Forklift, but when he said it, I mean, I wanted to tear all my hair out of my head because it's like, come on, you know. I mean, there's comparisons that you make, and then there's comparisons that make you look foolish, and that's the one that makes you look foolish, you know. I love watching the Kings. I like Jack Johnson a lot as a player. I love to watch him. I think he's an up and coming talented offensive defenseman. But to compare him to Brent Seabrook, who means more on his defense than Jack Johnson means on his, forget about accomplishments, is asinine.
Yeah, and you know, I think too that for whatever reason, when anybody, especially Hawks fans, places a number, you know, a cap figure on a player who's coming up as, you know, some sort of a free agent, you always have to add at least 25% to that number. Always. It never, ever works out quite like fans, I suppose, want it to. And, you know, if you think Jack Johnson is the starting point, or if you think something just north of Hjalmarsson is the starting point, add the premium to that, and, you know, now you're sort of in that 5.5 range that you mentioned. And like I think we both said, he's going to get his money somewhere unless for whatever reason he decides that, you know, there are more important things. And, you know, if history is any indicator, especially with this group, he's not going to do that.
All right. Superstar, I want to move along. We don't have that much time left, but the All-Star game's coming up this weekend. I don't know about you guys. I never watch it. It's the biggest waste of time. It's a great weekend. If you attempt to do what guys like us do, it's a great weekend to take off. It's an excellent vacation weekend. Superstar, I'll start with you. Are you excited about the changes in the All-Star game, and are you going to watch this weekend's All-Star game?
I can care less about the changes because, no, there's no chance in hell I'm watching 1 minute of it.
Even the draft on Friday night, which is probably the most intriguing aspect of the whole weekend.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that is the most intriguing thing of the whole weekend. I may catch a little bit of that, but come game time, yeah, no, I won't be watching any part of that.
Any thoughts on that, guys?
Yeah, I'd say I'm a pretty big All-Star kind of guy. For whatever reason, I like the All-Star game in all sports. I've never been able to pay much attention to the Pro Bowl, but I like them in all the other sports. I do find it quite amusing, though. And for what it's worth, I never watch the games, but I do really typically enjoy, you know, sort of all the hoopla and the skills type things that each sport has, you know, in the day or two that lead up to the game. That's it's unanimous. The game is worthless. I do think it's really interesting, though, that they add this idea. Apparently, they spent a whole hell of a lot of time trying to think this up, you know, took the Major League Baseball type approach and tried to, you know, do something that might assign a little bit more value in the players' minds to the game. And so they institute this draft, and what does one of the captains of one of the teams say a few days before the draft? He says that he's just going to be picking buddies and guys he hangs out with over the summer. So it's clear that even before the game starts, even before the draft is an issue, we already have one of the two guys who's in it saying that, no, he doesn't even give a shit. So it's very confusing then, I guess, for fans to, for whatever reason, to enjoy the game when you know that no one who's involved in it is assigning it any value whatsoever.
John, do you have a problem? I'm sorry, but Patrick Kane, there was some people, especially like the Blackhawks beat writers, were appalled that Patrick Kane was named an alternate captain, not understanding that it's a television show and it doesn't matter. Did you have any problem with that whatsoever?
Yeah, I thought it was the same thing. I thought it was hysterical how, like, up in arms everybody was over Patrick Kane being named an alternate. But, you know, I have no problem with that whatsoever. I mean, it's for one game, and who gives a rat's ass? You know, they're looking for guys who are characters and who can market the game. And, you know, Patrick Kane can do that far better than, you know, somebody like Jonathan Toews or, you know, Pavel Datsyuk's hurt. But, you know, somebody who can speak English and people that are their viewing audience can relate to. So, yeah, I think there was nothing wrong with naming Patrick Kane the alternate. I thought that was a kind of a funny pseudo-controversy that the Hawk beat writers picked up on.
Yeah. Right. And again, it's important to remember that nobody cares. You know,
right.
Nobody who's involved in the game cares any way whatsoever. You know, it's the draft, I think, would be a really, really cool idea if, you know, if somebody cared. But again, you know, the fundamental issue here, and it's, you know, it's one that, you know, baseball tried to tackle, nobody cares. And so until somebody figures that out, and a lot of smart people have tried, it's never going to be something that anybody's going to be interested in.
Moving along, one of the things that's come up, and we got in March, we got the GM meetings come up. There's serious topics to talk about, like headshots, but I think we're all in agreement that headshots are bad, and the NHL needs to do something to get rid of them. But one of the topics that's going to come up is the shootout, and Kenny Holland has this, you know, crazy idea of, like, we'll do a 10-minute overtime, and we'll do this part of it's going to be 4-on-4, and this part of it will be 3-on-3, and then I guess at some point it'll be 1-on-1. But the shootout format, Superstar, we'll start with you, then we'll go around. Anything that you could think of to make it better, or is it fine the way it is?
I think it's fine the way it is. I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago and talked about making it a five-shooter shootout, but I have no problem with the way it is right now.
Bob?
Yeah, I'm sort of a Superstar. You know, I think the idea here is that the 4-on-4 and the shootout, it's gimmicky. You know, it's a gimmick. You know, and it's just as much as Patrick Kane being the alternate captain. This is, you know, this is a gimmick. This is used to drum up some level of anticipation that wasn't there in the days where the game would just sort of end after 5 minutes. So whether they add more gimmicks or, you know, change the gimmicks a little bit, I don't think I care.
Yeah, it's their options to me are you either keep it the way it is or go back to the old way. I think you start screwing around by making it 4-on-4 and 3-on-3 and 2-on-2. I think you're starting to border on the ridiculous.
Well, yeah, the 3-on-3, I don't think would work at all. There's too much ice out there for three players.
Right. Exactly.
The thing that I think, people forget why. We have a shootout. It's because, you know, I mean, it never bothered me in the 80s and 90s to walk out of a building, you know, after a tie, but I guess you'd call me a hockey purist. It never bothered me. But you know what? If you go to work the next day, if you're someone that you know, spends $75 to $150, or, you know, even if you spend less, you're still with beer and parking and all that, you're still spending at least $75. You go to work the next day and say, hey, what'd you do last night? I went to a hockey game. Oh, who won? Well, nobody won, you know. I mean, I think there's a problem with that. So, and that was a complaint. So they go to the shootout thing, and at least you have a resolution. I think the one thing to tweak, and people talk about the 3-point format, I want to get rid of awarding a point just for getting to overtime. I think it takes away some of that excitement from the 5-minute overtime. You can keep it 4-on-4. That's the only thing that I would change. Because that way, especially down the stretch as you're going down through, this time of year with divisional and conference battles and trying to get that extra point, keep that extra point away from someone that you're fighting for a playoff spot with, it makes overtime mean more. Whereas they already got the point, and now let's just not lose that extra point in overtime. We'll get to the shootout. I'd like to see that happen. But you can't extend overtime any, because it's going to be the same. It'll be just for your top two lines that are playing, which means more time for those guys, which means more risk for injury and all of that. And the other thing, if you want to get rid of the shootout, then shouldn't you be getting rid of penalty shots? Because isn't that the same thing? You know, Marion Hossa's penalty shot on Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon, that was a one-on-one skills competition that could have swung the momentum in a game. you know. So isn't that the same thing? You know, she got to get rid of that too. So.
Yeah, you know, I think though that if they take the stance that they'll get rid of that, you know, the point for the loser. I mean, I think then they're really, really embracing the shootout. And, you know, I don't see the league being at that point. You know, because then not only do you have the shootout deciding the outcome of the game, who gets the extra point, now you're deciding who doesn't get a point at all. And,
oh, no,
you know,
no, I didn't make it clear enough. If you get to the shootout, then, yeah, each side gets a point. I just meant Yeah, I just meant that for getting into overtime the way it is now, like once regulation ends, it's a tie, each team gets a point. I want that extended 5 minutes so the 2 points are still in play, you know, in overtime. And then, yeah, once you get to the shootout, then, yeah, each side deserves a point.
I think that's fine. I think that sounds like a good idea, actually.
Before we, a couple things I want to get to before we wrap up, I want to make a couple of notes. Now, tomorrow, and I think it will be today when most people are listening to this, January 25th, Tuesday, Chris Chelios, 49 years old. Do you think he's going to play hockey yet? Do you think he's done? You think so? You think we'll see Chris Chelios pop up for, you know, a gimmick when he turns 50 next year? In some league, ECHL, anywhere?
To get, like, a shift like Gordie Howe did?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they might do that, I think as far as being a regular on a team, I think those days are done for him.
I'll probably see him getting
a shift.
I don't see it. He's not the ambassador that Howe is. I don't think anybody really...
I love Chelios, but Chelios, you know, he's a pretty selfish guy. So, you know, I could still see him doing it. That's why I posed the question. I don't want to see it. You know, I won't be up in arms. You know, I won't be up in arms if he did it because it's just Chelly. But, you know, and no one's going to give him that opportunity at the NHL, and I doubt anybody will even do it at the AHL. I could see that Chicago team's coming in, and, you know, the Chicago CHL team, whatever it's being called, Chicago Express, I think, that's going to be out of season.
Yeah, yep.
I could see that happening. You know, the last time they tried minor league hockey at that building, it failed miserably. I see it happening again. Maybe they'll try something with him. The very next day, big issue of the hockey news this week, on Wednesday, January 26th, Wayne Gretzky is 50. Can you believe that? My God, now I'm old. I remember when I was growing up, I told this story on the story. I shouldn't tell this story because I'll get made fun of, I'm sure, somewhere. But when I was a little kid, my mom and dad got me. Wayne Gretzky was my favorite player. You know, obviously, he was most people's favorite player. But I had this Wayne Gretzky doll that slept next to me every night when I was like 5 years old. And there you know some of my secrets. Wayne Gretzky.
Is that weird that you did it when you're five? It's just weird that you still have it.
I saw it the last time I was at in my mother's basement. Okay. John, I wanted to bring this up. You wrote an article, I thought it was a fantastic article, ways back now, about Dustin Byfuglien. I don't think that the four of us could do a show without talking about Dustin Byfuglien at least for a little bit. Now, it was more to the point, and I didn't get a chance to go back and read it today, I wanted to, but it was more to the point about, correct me if I'm wrong, but about Dustin Byfuglien didn't fit here on defense. Am I right?
Yeah, that was the gist of it. You know, the idea had started to pop up. I heard it on the radio. I think Barry Rosner was hosting the afternoon show on The Score, and for about 2 or 3 days, he was railing against the Hawks for about how they could ever let go of this star defenseman that they had, that they didn't even know they had. And, you know, all you had to do was go back and take a look at just a couple old box scores, a couple old articles, and it wasn't too difficult to realize why Dustin Byfuglien was never a defenseman in Chicago. You know, I mean, the answers are all right in front of us. You know, they had an absolutely loaded farm system on the back end with about four guys who, at the time, were already better defensemen than him. And they had nobody up front. And I think just – and it wasn't – and the other thing that was, you know, that was being said is that, oh, it was Dale Talon. Dale Talon was the only one that made that decision, Dale Talon and Dennis Savard. Well, wait a second. Stan Bowman and Joel Quenneville had just as much time to take a look at Dustin Byfuglien and say, oh, this guy is going to be a point per game. Well, he's not a point per game defenseman, but, you know, this guy is going to score 20 from the back and, you know, maybe assist on 40 and be on your top power play unit and everything else. Joel Quenneville had just as much opportunity to take a look at him and say, you know, this is a guy that we should be having on defense. What are we doing? What are we doing having him up at forward? You know, and I think that's kind of where it started to become revisionist history, and I kind of wanted to nip that in the bud as soon as possible to say, well, now wait a second. This is why Dustin Byfuglien was a forward. This is who was on defense for the Hawks when he came up as a defenseman, and these were all guys who were better than him on defense. And these are guys at forward who he was better than. So I just think that, you know, it was more of a preemptive strike to kind of quell the people that were bemoaning the fact that they got rid of this amazing defenseman that they never knew they had.
Yeah. Now, obviously, he got off to an amazing start, and I made the point a couple of weeks ago when we did the show. You know, I don't think at the end of the year anybody will be making the argument for Dustin Byfuglien as a Norris Trophy winner. And I know all the arguments against it at the halfway point, but my argument would be in that category, what player had the single most, you know, the biggest impact on his team? I don't think you could argue that it'd be Dustin Byfuglien. Now that Dustin Byfuglien isn't playing, you know, he's not as hot. And, you know, I explained, in my opinion, why that wasn't going to continue is because no matter how well he was playing on defense, and I'm not an advocate of him being on defense, that at some point, Craig Ramsey has to reel him in because the risk-reward in that riverboat gambler type of a game that Dustin Byfuglien has on defense is too great for a team that is teetering on the playoffs even when he's playing terrifically. So Byfuglien was going to naturally have to be reined in and come back to the pack anyway, and that's when more all-around defensemen, Lidstrom, Seabrook, Keith, guys like that, Weber, I go on and on and on. Pronger, Chara will you know, go to the forefront. You won't be talking about Byfuglien anymore. But I think it's for a first half, it was amazing. It's nothing that I didn't see in Norfolk and in the brief moments that he had in Rockford, in which Mike Havlin let him do whatever the heck he wanted to do. He was never coached, which was the problem with him when he got to Chicago, is that he was never coached. He was allowed to do whatever he wanted to do, and that didn't work, as John, you tried to point out in your article. It never didn't work in the system that Joel Quenneville and, well, Dennis Farr didn't really have a system, but it wasn't going to work in Joel Quenneville. So, you know, but, yeah, now Atlanta is in dire straits. I know Rick Dudley's up in Chicago or following the Wolves around this week because they already traded Ben Eager, but they've got moves to make because they really, you know, there's a sense of urgency there in Atlanta for that team to make the playoffs, and they're sort of spiraling downward. If the playoffs were to start today based on point percentage and projections and all that, Carolina would get the eighth spot. Atlanta would be on the outside looking in. Andrew Ladd, Bob, I don't know how much you've seen of Atlanta this year. I'm just watching him. I mean, there's something about a player, I think, when they get that captaincy that it makes them a better player immediately, and Andrew Ladd's that type of guy. You know, we knew that the Blackhawks were losing something in Andrew Ladd, but did you expect what we've seen in Atlanta this year with Andrew Ladd?
No, not at all. And, you know, I think what people do forget, or maybe what a lot of people didn't know, just because, you know, as a function of when the Blackhawks got good, but, you know, Andrew Ladd, he wasn't brought in to be a third-line winger. And he got ample opportunity to be something other than that and just never was able to. And, you know, ultimately, of course, ended up finding his niche. But the Blackhawks did all they could to steer him in a different direction. And he wasn't able to get to that point. And so, yeah, I'm really surprised. I mean, I thought Atlanta was getting a solid two-way guy, but, you know, not quite this.
How much have you seen of Ladd this year, John?
You know, brief snippets. I'll catch on the fly. And, you know, I think I've caught a couple Thrasher games. He's been another guy who's kind of cooled off a bit. You know, him and Buffalo were on point-per-game paces, I think, all the way up until maybe a couple weeks ago when the Thrashers went on a bit of their downslide. But, yeah, I mean, I would agree with what you said as far as a guy who gets the C on his jersey and just kind of, you know, just revels in it and becomes almost a completely different player. And, you know, that's Ladd. I mean, he's, from what I've seen, he's almost a completely different player as far as the offensive side of the game now. That all of a sudden he's got this, you know, this offensive talent that really nobody really knew that he had here. I mean, when he, you know, as Bob said, when they first got him here, you know, I think the idea was to play him with Kane and Taves and to kind of get that guy to clear some space and, you know, give him that defensive zone responsibility, but he just couldn't play with them. Now all of a sudden, you know, he's his own man in Atlanta.
Yeah, and I think, you know, with all due respect to Rich Peverly and Brian Little, they're not, you know, Kane and Taves. But, you know, he's found his niche there, and his sense to be around the net at the, you know, at the right times, which is something that Brian Bickell doesn't have. You know, Troy Brower has a little bit, but I mean, I've been so impressed with Andrew Ladd this year, and just really in love with the kind of player that he's become as the captain there. Because again, I mean, it's, you know, nobody talks about Andrew Ladd's season last year and his stretches of 15 games without a goal and 3 points in that span. And nobody called Andrew Ladd lazy. But, you know, I mean, those are the kind of things that existed with him last year. And this year, yeah, he's just a different player. We're going to wrap up now, but I do want to say, you know, you guys talked about, you know, the Team Canada defensemen and what those guys are making. Just keep this in mind. Dion Phaneuf is making $6.5 million a year. That's his cap hit. And he's got a 6-year deal, and that's his cap number, 6.5. So, I mean, to think that Brent Seabrook is going to get less money than Dion Phaneuf, I mean, I don't know who makes that argument. But I think you'd compare Brent Seabrook to that contract before you'd even think about doing it with the Jack Johnson contract. But
yeah, the facts aren't pretty.
Things to think about. Well, you know what? Well, we do have a second. Patrick Sharp, he's got another year on his deal. Ultimately, we don't know what the salary cap's going to look like or even what the CBA is going to look like. But I think it's safe to say that the salary cap's here to stay. Ultimately, you know, and I mean, there's variables here. Will Jeremy Morin ever be healthy enough to become the player that we think he's going to be? But is Patrick Sharp long-term, is he a Blackhawk?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's one of those guys who will age gracefully. I think he's a guy that you can kind of shoe in for 20 to 25 goals probably until he's about 35, 36 years old, and maybe onward to that. I think he's just one of those guys who has a game that'll translate as he gets older.
Yeah, he's been great in this last little stretch.
And he plays, you know, all positions and, you know, all in all three phases. You know, I think he's a must-keep. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
All right, guys. You know, thefifthfeather.com. And I know that tomorrow night in the Committed Indian, you give a little sneak preview. Do you want to or about what's
Yeah, sure. We're just revisiting the Marian Hossa-Martin Havlat decision. With Minnesota Wild and Martin Havlat back in town.
That's a heck of a comparison right these days.
Yeah, well, we figured that you would enjoy it, and we're hoping that it came out right. It was a little tough to construct and stuff, but hopefully it works out.
I love, you know, for the record, I love both players, but you know what? Blackhawks need more out of Marian Hossa. It's not enough. It wasn't enough last year. It's not enough this year. And I'm sick and tired of people giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Well, he has another 11 years to figure it out.
All right, Bob and John, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll do this again, I'm sure, in the near future.
Glad to be on. Thanks, Chris.
And the Committed Indian tomorrow night. Superstar will be back next Monday night, January 31st, 8 o'clock, here at blogtalkradio.com/thethirdmanin. And that's about it. Good night, everybody.
Such a fine line between stupid and clever.